Welcome to Food Matters Live. This is the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Today, we continue our series of interviews with leading figures in the food sector, getting under the surface to discover what motivates and inspires them, and looking at their work to see how it's shaping the future of food. In this edition, my guest is Saliha Mahmoud Ahmed. Now, anyone who's a fan of the MasterChef TV series will instantly know Saliha's name from her 2017 triumph and the fantastic Kashmiri-influenced food that she created on the show. But not content with being a wonderful chef, she's also a medical doctor with a specialism in digestive disorders, and she's also a campaigner aiming to improve food provision in the NHS. And Saliha is an author too. Her book Kazana is an Indo-Persian cookbook with recipes inspired by the Mughals. And Foodology is a food lover's guide to digestive health and happiness. Hello there, Saliha. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. What a pleasure. What an introduction.
I do like that. Throwing a few words at the problem there. Now, obviously, we'll talk about the MasterChef triumph in a bit. You can't avoid it. But first of all, let's just talk about what is your favourite dish? Do you have a favourite dish, or is there a favourite situation within which to eat, or a way to eat?
A lot of people ask me this question, what's your favourite dish? And I almost feel it's like asking which one of your children is your favourite.
Yeah, I've definitely got one. Definitely. One of my children's definitely. But I wouldn't tell them that.
It's a really difficult one. For me, like, a lot of my emotions and moods are linked to the foods that I want at that moment in time. For me, anything with good texture is really my desert island dish. I am that person who stuffs crisps inside their egg sandwiches, you know.
I am that person.
I'm particularly fond of pani puri. I don't know if you've ever had pani puri before.
But what sort of puri is that?
So pani puri, otherwise known as gol gappa, is an Indian Pakistani street food snack. They're crisp sort of domed shells which the pani puri vendor will make a hole in and then stuffed with some spiced chickpeas and potatoes, and then the whole thing gets dunked in this tamarind mint spicy broth, and then you have to take the whole thing in your mouth and just go hum and eat it all without spilling juice down your front and on your clothes, or do, you know, whichever you prefer. And it's just the most joyous sensory experience you can possibly imagine. And it's mandatory to have it at a roadside stall. Mm. You can't have it in a posh restaurant. It's mandatory to be boiling hot, and it's mandatory to wait at least 15 minutes in a queue to get it.
It's all part of the theatre of the dish, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the food culture that you grew up in. I've already mentioned the Kashmiri influence on your cooking. And by the way, I have to say, your book is absolutely beautiful as well. And I love the fact that it's got history to it as well as recipes. I think it's a fantastic balance. But tell us about the food culture you grew up in and sort of your early food memories.
For us, we're a Muslim family. Alcohol doesn't feature in our family. And food really, really does predominate, take center stage every single occasion, birth, death, and everything in between. I grew up in a climate where my mum was a professional working as a doctor, as was my dad, back in the days in the NHS where part-time work and less than full-time training didn't exist. And she was working very, very hard. And despite that, and having two, then three children later on, she still made the provision of hot, nutritious food every single night. And it was Pakistani food that she made for us. So I grew up having good, freshly cooked hot meals every day, and that was the norm. And then there was these big foodie figures in my family, not necessarily the men, it was always the women, you know, my grandmothers, for example, both of them. One in particular was very fat and very into food. And she was celebrated for her ability to make absolutely anything out of what was available. So I recall being young, and we lived in NHS hospital accommodation, somewhere in the Midlands, I think Nottingham at the time.
You're not painting the most beautiful picture there, I have to say.
It gets better, I promise. behind the hospital accommodation was this apple tree. And it was summertime, and it was British cooking apples that were growing on this apple tree. And 99.9% of them were falling on the floor and rotting and stinking out the place. And my grandmother saw this tree and with these fat, juicy apples on them. And lo and behold, for the next few days, all we had was apple-based food. So we had a special Kashmiri apple curry that's called bhamchond, which is just literally apples which are stewed in a spiced tomato curry. We had apple jams, we had apple puree in baby food, we had apple chutneys, we had apple pies, we had apple crumble. I mean, literally everything you could do with that apple happened, because it was so painful to her see all of these apples being wasted. We had to utilize them in some way. So that's the kind of food culture I came from. It was like, you know, if people came to your house, you know, anything and everything you had in your cupboards, you know, came out for them. All the biscuits came out, all the drinks came out, the tea came out, the coffee came out, the samosas came out. You know, even if they weren't hungry, they got fed a paratha stuffed with lamb. And then, you know, once they'd been fed that, they were asked to eat a banana for, you know, no reason at all. So, you know, it was that kind of climate that I grew up in. And that's what shaped me to be the cook that I am today.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so if we take the concept of Kazana, the book, tell us a little bit about it. I mean, it's beautiful, the design. I mean, you know, it's not just the photos, it's beautifully wrought, isn't it? It's got all the depth of illustration that you wouldn't normally get in a cookbook. But it's about updated historical recipes from the time of the Mughal Empire. What was the inspiration and why?
Often people said to me, well, how do you categorize your food? And I would say, well, it's sort of Indian subcontinent, predominantly Pakistani, but then there's a huge Persian influence as well in my cooking. And so, well, how did you come to get to that point in your cooking? And the answer is my travels as a child. And my parents took us to all the areas which were influenced by the Mughal Empire as children. So we traveled across Central Asia, the north of Pakistan, northern India. You know, we visited all the heritage sites. My parents grew up in Pakistan, so their history lessons were the history of the Mughals. They didn't learn about Tudors and, you know, like we did. And so for them, it was really important culturally to take us to all of these different sites. Mm-hmm. And we ate outside of those sites and we learned about the different emperors that were around. And we had, you know, illustrated books from that time, painting a picture of what life for the Mughals was like. And so I grew up with this sort of separate history running alongside the parallel history that one gets from a conventional British education. So there was these two streams in tandem. And when it came to writing my own cookbook, I think for me, it was about getting all of that together and packaging it in a way where I could tell people about this fascinating food history that exists in this part of the world, which very few people know about. I mean, you say Mughal and the only thing people can say is, oh, yes, Taj Mahal, you know, and actually to understand the art and architecture and the immense pleasure that food brought these people and how they were so enthusiastic about food and how they lived and died for food is what I really wanted to portray in the book.
Yeah,
it was easy to make the book look beautiful because actually Mughal art and architecture is so rich. So you already have all that existing material to draw inspiration from.
And it's just beautiful. I mean, I kind of, I've said it about five times already, but the book itself is it's stunning.
So, I've
visited Afghanistan, and I wondered how much of the Mughal Empire sort of drifts into Afghanistan. It sort of ends really at Pakistan, does it?
Well, no, actually, a lot of it is in Afghanistan as well. So it starts in Central Asia. Sort of, we're talking about sort of Samarkand region. That's where the first Mughal Empire Babur was from. And then they travelled through Iran and they travelled through Afghanistan and into Pakistan and India as it's known today. Of course, at that time, it was just one big area, Hindustan. And they conquered all of that massive, massive territory. And they ruled over it for many years until the empire eventually dissolved when the British Raj came into existence, etc. Now, the food influence is amazing because, yes, it started in Central Asia with Central Asian food, but then they really looked to the Persians as the tone and the real sort of, they were the center point of cuisine for them. They were really the sophisticated cooks and they really took to the cooking techniques. They learned all the cooking techniques from the Persians. They held the Persians in very, very high regard. And then they moved all of those techniques that they learned to Pakistan and India, and there they found a whole vast array of new spices and ingredients and cookery methods, and they imbibed all of that and they used all of it. And luxury, I mean, it was luxury at a different scale. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these recipes that I was looking at were using multiple kilograms of cashews, you know, and blending them down. And, you know, I calculated that if I cooked a dish for four using the same technique, it would essentially come to something like 56 pounds, which, you know, is a highly unrealistic target. So I really had to work on how I could modernize these recipes to make them suitable for a 21st century kitchen. And that was really the joy of it. But What I find really, really interesting is that the head of the kitchen in the Mughal Empire was always a doctor called the Hakim, which is really ironic that I, in my dual career as a doctor so many years later, am then writing a cookbook about Mughal cuisine in the 21st century, modernizing it in line with 21st century eating habits. So I just love that. I just felt like when I learned that part of it, I just felt that, you know, history had gone full circle and come back.
Yeah, and it's coming back to you, and I love that. Okay, now we can't avoid this, MasterChef. Now, I'm sure you've been asked again and again, how did it feel to win MasterChef? So in a desperate attempt to make you slightly more interested in the question, I'd like to ask you about any surprises about the experience of winning MasterChef. Well, I mean, it must have affected your life immensely, but was there anything that particularly surprised you? Because you kind of think, when you're doing it, you must be dreaming of winning. You must be dreaming that it's going to transform your experience. What surprises came at you after winning?
Well, I couldn't go to Tesco in my pyjamas anymore. I literally couldn't. And, you know, you do the nighttime cheeky run to Tesco down the road to pick up a packet of crisps and, I don't know, some milk or whatever the kids needed that day. And then all of a sudden it was like, are you Saleha? Oh, my God, you're Saleha. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm wearing slippers right now and my pyjamas. No longer can I go to the shops wearing my pyjamas anymore. So that was a big surprise. Mm-hmm. The other big surprise for me really was the fact that people had a very, very poor understanding, broadly speaking, of the world of spice, because I found that the criticism that I received after winning the show was that I was only able to cook a curry, which is A, far from the truth, and B, what is a curry in the first place anyway? And I felt that a very sophisticated food culture where spice is the center point, but celebrated and nuanced and done in very beautiful, diverse ways, was actually being assimilated and simplified into one very small thing, aka something we understand as curry, which couldn't be further from the truth, as you would know, Stefan. But for me, it was really a starting point to say, well, actually, look, we are at this point where actually it's very important to teach people about the nuances, where this food came from, what Indo-Persian cuisine is, what Mughals are, what regional variations of food are, you know, and that's all in line now with the way that this country is moving. I mean, I see this gradual steady decline, at least where I'm living, in the local Indian takeaway. People are much less interested in that and far more interested in fun regional variations. They're more interested in what the Sri Lankan new place that's opened around the corner is offering and what dosas are, and they're more interested in the Chaiwala place, which is offering tea and roadside snacks influenced by North Indian cuisine. So there's this new regionality that's opening up and this new celebration of different parts of Indian Indo-Persian cuisine in our country, which I'm very excited to be part of and to be able to observe this new age of curry which is coming round to our country.
Yeah. And have you been sort of caught up at all in the kind of rage against concepts of authenticity recently? So you're defining a specific kind of region as your basket of inspiration. There's been, I mean, a huge amount of Twitter spats about people, you know, writing about a cuisine that maybe you know, they don't come from or they were born in a different country. Have you had any flack along those kind of lines?
I must admit, I tread the line very carefully when it comes to those things. So I'm always very honest with my cooking. So I will say, you know, my book is not authentic Mughal food because it just cannot be. It is inspired by Mughal cuisine and it is made for 21st century cooks and kitchens. So I think where you are clear about your objectives, then you actually manage to avoid this whole debate. So, you know, something that is Moroccan inspired X, Y, and Z versus a Moroccan X, Y, and Z becomes a very, very different thing. So for me, it's all about having that clarity about what you're doing, you know?
Yeah. Chorizo in paella. Oh my God. Yeah. Let's rise above all that right now. Now, I mean, you're an amazing cook, but you're a home cook really, aren't you? But didn't you win the Best Chef Award at the British Restaurant Awards?
I did, yes.
What's all that about? How does that work?
Well, I don't know really. I did win the Best Chef at the British Restaurant Awards. The people nominated in the Best Chef category, I think I was doing a fair amount of pop-ups and stuff at the time. Yeah. So I think people were eating my food in the way they would in a restaurant. And there was other people in the category of best chef. And then obviously there's the recipes that came out for the book. So somehow I managed to win an award without a restaurant.
Stealing the awards from all the big chefs. But I love that. And do you think there's enough respect given to home cooks? You know, there are so many writers of books are home cooks. You know, Nigella's a home cook. Nigel Slate, home cooks. And yet, you know, they're not chefs making food for, you know, 100 people a day. Do you think that the home cooks get enough respect, or is it just the state of things and it will always be like that?
Well, I think home chefs get respect from the people that they're cooking from. So, you know, if you're cooking for a party, for your family, you have that respect level. And actually, that needs to be broadened and celebrated much more broadly. So, yes, that is why people like Nigella and so forth are so popular, because I think they really do something that people can understand with. So a professional cook cooks in a kitchen as their profession. You know, that's their absolute profession. That's what they do in, day out. But a home cook isn't recognised as much. They do it at home with a lot of love, a lot of caring, a lot of affection, and actually bringing their unique skill set, things they've honed in their own kitchen, their own way of thinking about food, their own way of presenting food, which is totally different to the things that what chefs are doing. It's actually something that's quite special. Mm. I think we have to celebrate MasterChef as a format for actually being able to put home cooks out on a pedestal and say, look, these people are doing fantastic jobs and they have their own way of thinking about food, and celebrating the immense food cooking culture that exists across our country. I think it's amazing how many good home cooks there are. And I think since doing the show, I've been seeing how, by watching shows like MasterChef, so many people are inspired to be better versions of home cooks themselves,
yeah,
which is amazing. And, you know, I resonate with chefs working in kitchens, but I really, really resonate with home cooks.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into this conversation to ask a quick favour. I've been hosting this podcast for more than 3 years now, and we love that our community has stuck with us and grown in that time. But instead of me doing all the talking, we want to hear from you. We'd love to hear your comments, your suggestions, criticisms, and questions. Are there any topics you think we should be covering? Any guests that you really want to hear from? Let us know by email at info@foodmatterslive.com. Or contact us on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. And if you like what you're hearing, it would be enormously helpful if you could leave us a review of the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred platform. Thank you so much for listening, and now back to the chat. Now, one of the reasons why it's so fascinating to talk to you is that there's a whole other aspect of your life which is immensely important and is related to food as well. So you're also a doctor, you're working in gastroenterology, and you're an expert in digestive disorders. Now, how does your clinical work affect your view of the food culture in this country? Are you mopping up the messes of bad diets in the UK?
The short answer is yes. I think in my job every day, I see the sequelae of poor health outcomes that are directly influenced by poor eating habits. And that's not poor eating habits over a day, a week, a month. That's years and years and years of poor eating that culminate in a person's ill health. And it affects every single part of people's body, from, you know, just your heart, to your lungs, to your liver, to your risk of developing cancer and strokes and ischemic heart disease, and people dying younger than they should be doing. And I think, for me, when I take a step back, it's, you know, when I started my career, it was all about learning how to cure illness, how to start giving treatments, what pills were appropriate. And really now, when I take a step back and think about patients now, I can think about them away from the pills and the treatments they're on, and think about what we could have done to prevent that patient being there in the first place. And almost always, the answer doesn't lie in giving them any sort of preventative pill. The answer always lies in what was on their plate and what we could have done to prevent them getting there in the first place. Mm. And so I sort of almost make it my life's mission to try and encourage people to eat properly and eat well. And I must admit, I'm one of the few doctors who actually does this. There is a growing body of doctors who are interested in lifestyle medicine and food. But by no means is the average doctor equipped at the moment to be able to have those conversations. Mm. We've always outsourced it to dietetics. But now we're realizing more and more the importance of lifestyle medicine, and food is such a massive part of lifestyle medicine.
And is that beginning to change? I mean, do doctors have access to more to training in nutrition? And if so, do they take it up?
Well, they have to now, because things are changing. For the first time in the last year or so, we've actually had a change whereby nutrition has become a core part of the medical student curriculum. Mm. So now nationally, nutrition is taught, which is just fantastic. There is, I think, much more recognition about the importance of understanding patient-level nutrition and having those conversations when people come into hospital and those key GP-led interactions. It doesn't take that long. I think people think, oh, if I start talking about people's eating and food, it's going to take ages. But it really doesn't. Sometimes short, sharp bursts of advice are really important and actually do wonders for people.
And scaring the hell out of them. No, that's not the right approach, is it?
Well, yes, scaring is one thing, but also I think often their health condition scares them.
Yeah.
And when you have that person who's had a certain health, an index health event, being able to get them then and say, look, the way we can prevent this from going forward is by doing X, Y, and Z. And I want to see you in 2 weeks' time again to have another telephone conversation with you to see if you've been managed to make any changes to your diet in that time. Go here, see this website. I'm going to send you out leaflets X, Y, and Z, which are going to tell you exactly how to do this. I'll send a referral to a dietitian for you. It will take a couple of months to come through, but please do and try these, do these things in between. You would be surprised. People know what to do. People know instinctively what is right and what is wrong.
And do you think they knew that already and just needed somebody in your position to say, come on, pull yourself together?
Partly, yes. I think people do know it already. People have, there's so many different barriers for people. I mean, you look at the psychological models that have been created for instigating behaviour change in people, and you'll realise that a lot of it is about who that person is, their personality, their additional psychology, but, you know, psychological factors that play a huge part in their decision making, financial factors, the sort of food climate they live in, the people they're surrounded by, what shops they are surrounded by. So it's a, this really complex kind of network. But when you kind of disturb that a little bit with a health problem and with some advice, you find some really fun, interesting things are happening in people's life, for the better, of course.
And are there any particular tools or ways of coming at it? Where does most of your success come? Because achieving dietary change, I think, is really tough for some people. I'm surprised that you're saying, it can be done. So that's, I find that really exciting. But what are the things that really seem to make an impact, where people go away and say, yeah, I took your advice and I'm following it? How have you managed to do that? What's the gold dust?
Well, I think you really have to break down for people what they're having for breakfast, lunch and dinner every single day and say, tell me, how did you come to that decision? Okay, right, let's take a step back. How could we alter that? So, for example, let's take dinner as an example. You know, you'll talk to people about what they had for dinner, and then you'll see, oh, look, you know, from what you've told me in the last week, every single dinner that you've had has had basically some red or processed meat in it. What do you think about maybe like reducing the amount of red and processed meat down a bit so that we can get your cholesterol down, and having a couple of days where you try some vegetarian dinners instead? So how about switching over the spaghetti bolognese that you said you had on there and doing a lentil bolognese instead? Or how about instead of having a fish finger sandwich, maybe you could try some tofu in that same way that you did it? Or perhaps you could just like have a vegetable ratatouille that day instead of having that thing that you did, you know, and you offer them like alternatives that you know that they will like, which are vegetarian. You make them see, you take, again, it's all about perspective, isn't it? When you're in it every day, you don't think about it. When you take a step back and say, oh, hello, 7 days last week you had meat for dinner, you know, then they say, oh gosh, okay, you're right. And you say, okay, well let's take another meal. Let's take your snacks, for example. So I love snacks. I have crisps and chocolate every day sometimes. And
that's coming through.
That happens. That does happen. You know, I have a bad week, I have them every day. But for the most part, I know what snacks I should be eating. Let's look at your snacks. Tell me, in the last week, what snacks did you have? And then you break it down and you say, do you think maybe for that snack we could get a fruit in? I'm not saying do it every day, but try and do it every other day and see where you get. So really, you just have to make people realise what they're doing wrong and offer an alternative that would be acceptable to them.
not diving too far down the opposite route and scaring the hell out of them.
Totally. And it's all about celebrating diversity in the diet and saying, look, I am not the person asking you to diet. I'm not the person asking you to restrict eating. I'm not the person asking you to go keto. I'm not asking you to fast. All I'm asking you to do is try and improve the diversity of fruit and vegetables in your diet. I'm trying to improve the diversity of lentils that you eat. I'm trying to improve, I'm trying to add things for you, not take things out.
Yeah.
And when you frame it in that way and they think, oh, she's not telling me to, like, you know, be on a diet all the time. All she's saying is switch round to eating different things. Penny drops, and then suddenly you see a change.
Yeah, absolutely. We should at this point also mention your other book. I'm plugging your books like crazy here. But, Foodology. Just give us a very, very brief plug for Foodology. What's it about and why should people read it?
Yeah, so Foodology is for food lovers, and it is your guide to getting to a point where you reach digestive health and happiness. So it's about reaching that balance of eating for health, but also recognizing that you eat for pleasure. And the book starts with an explanation of the experience of tasting and why taste is so important. And then it moves on to things like how one should feed the gut microbiome and what one can do to prevent common ailments like bloating and constipation, etc. So it's a whole, it's basically my way of saying, I am a doctor, I am a chef, and this book is where those two worlds collide. And this is how you can treat lots of your digestive health problems, by understanding them and by eating specific foods. And it's really about celebrating food. It's a cookbook in the sense that, yes, it's a written book, but it has also got 50 recipes which illustrate some of the examples that I'm trying to make. So yeah, it's a really lovely, lovely book. Someone said to me, which is the biggest compliment that I've ever had, I won't tell you who it is actually someone famous, but he said to me that he reads my book in the toilet in the morning when he needs a poo.
Very good.
And I was so delighted, because that is what my book is there for. It is there for toilet reading, because it's just the perfect setting on the bog.
To work out what your food has done.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's talk about hospital food. I know that this is a very important aspect for you. Not just, I mean, a lot of people have talked about improving hospital food for patients, but you're coming at it from an extra angle as well, aren't you, by talking about food for staff. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I've been working as a doctor for over a decade now, and it's not been easy in that time. I work as a medical doctor, so I didn't get out of hospitals. I'm still very much in hospital training. And for that reason, I do night shifts. And night shifts are very, very difficult. They're difficult physically, they're difficult emotionally. You have far less staff available. And I have had occasions where I've got on night shifts where I've not been able to bring my own food in for whatever reason. I've got unwell kids, the food's run out at home, whatever. And there has been many occasions where I am starving on a night shift. And I just feel that that is unacceptable. Because food for me, and you can probably sense this, Stefan, that food for me is so much about caring. When I cook for someone, I show them that I am caring for them. And that's something inculcated from childhood, from the time where, you know, my grandmother fed me apple curry, from the time when my mother cooked for us when, you know, when we were young, even though she was working. Food equals caring for that person. And for me, I really, really think NHS staff should be valued. And one of the ways that we can show NHS staff that we care for them and value them is by providing them access to hot, nutritious, affordable meal 24/7. Mm. Yes, we have some canteens open in the day. A lot of places don't have canteens open at night. Yes, we have some vending machines in the day. Those vary. Vending machines can have healthy food. They can have very, very unhealthy food in them. You have some places where there is absolutely no access to food whatsoever at all at night. So there's this whole patchwork quilt of problems with provision of food for staff. I'm not asking for free food for NHS staff. I'm asking for them to be able to have access to hot, affordable, nutritious food, the availability of it.
The availability of it, yeah, absolutely. And you're in a context where you've got patients and you're trying to give them nutritional advice and you simply cannot follow it yourself.
Well, I mean, you do it a 12-hour shift, and if you've forgotten your food, and maybe if you didn't have dinner before you came in, you know, that's 16 hours caring for people without actually being well nourished yourself, which is ludicrous in a way, isn't it, if you think about it?
And the campaign's called No Hungry Staff, is that right?
No Hungry Staff. The campaign's called No Hungry Staff. And I just think, you know, the crux of the matter is that we have to provide our patients the best possible care. And a doctor who is well fed, a nurse who is well fed, a porter who's well fed, any hospital staff member who is well fed is going to be in a position to be able to provide optimal care. So whilst, yes, this is a campaign for staff, ultimately, this is actually also a campaign which is of benefit to our patients. I sort of give the example of, you know, when you're in an aircraft and they say to you, in the event of a mask falling down, please ensure that your mask is on before you go and help other people. It is exactly the same concept for NHS food.
Absolutely. And if anyone listening is interested in the campaign and wants to find out more, where's the best place to go to find out about it and to add their voice?
We have a website and we have a Twitter page called @NoHungryStaff, where you can find out about it. My Instagram, Saliha Cooks, has links to it as well. So yeah, I mean, there's lots out there at the moment about it. You know, I've written pieces for the Metro, for the Independent News, just to try and elaborate upon the issue a lot. I talk about it a lot. I will regularly post about my experiences of NHS food at night. And behind the scenes, we're lobbying really hard, working really hard to try and get the 24/7 provision of food onto the Health and Social Care Bill this year so that it becomes mandatory. Currently, it's a recommendation. So various NHS bodies, the BMA, Food and Facilities Charter, etc., lots of different people have said, we recommend 24/7 provision of food.
Well, it's easy to recommend, isn't it?
Unless it becomes something mandatory, which trusts have to do, it won't happen.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we're at with the whole thing. And, you know, I've seen this immense drive towards people really wanting it and seeing the value in it, because COVID changed things for us. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, something extraordinary happened. All of a sudden, there was 24/7 provision of sort of restaurant quality food, actually.
That's right, yeah.
All of a sudden, overnight. So it showed us change is possible, and it showed us that we were highly effective as clinicians when we were well fed, and therefore it can be done, and we know anecdotally that it works. And that's why this campaign is so important, because going forward, you know, pandemic or no pandemic, we don't want to find ourselves in a situation where we're not fed overnight.
And I mean, amongst the enormous set of privations that are laid upon NHS staff, the idea that all you really want to do from this is get a decent meal and just have it available, it doesn't really seem that much to ask, does it? Okay, now, Saliha, let's look to the future. You've got so many skills. You're a doctor, you're a chef, you're an author, campaigner, you're a fantastic talker. You've got an incredible passion about food. You clearly love it and you love giving food. For me, it's the same sort of thing. It's an expression of love. But what's next for you? Where does your career go from here? And what have you got coming down the line? Have you got some big plans for the next few years, or are you going to focus on medicine?
Well, I have to tell you something, Stefan. Actually, I was looking at my medical school yearbook and... you know, I was at Guy's and St. Thomas's and we produced this yearbook and it's full of all these funny photographs of everybody doing silly things. And there's a picture of me standing under this pink umbrella in Prague on my elective. And one of the questions they asked us was, where do you see yourself in 10 years time? And I had written, probably doing the mum thing, which I am a mother of two boys, working in a hospital, which is definitely happening. And I probably have a restaurant or something. Right, which I just find so ironic, because no, I don't have a restaurant, but I have done so much more in the food arena. I had that inclination even then, deep in my subconscious, that food was going to be a part of my life. And I think the people who know me from then know that that is true. You know, I would get my student loan and blow it on lobster thermidor and then send pictures to my dad that I'd done it. You know, that was me. And then not eat anything proper for a week, you know, so that's kind of who I was. The future is looking good. I'm not sure I'm allowed to really tell you, but I can tell you it's a very exciting book coming in the Dr. Chef genre in the future. I would love, love, love to write more about regional Pakistani cuisine, and I hope to do that more in the future as well.
Excellent.
Yeah, the campaign goes on, the NHS work goes on. I will become a consultant in the near future. I shall be still doing your endoscopies and colonoscopies, people of the United Kingdom. So yeah, that's me, you know, spoon in one hand, colonoscope in the other.
That's an image I really need to get out of my head, but thank you for it anyway. Salia, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Stefan.
You've been listening to Salia Mahmoud Ahmed. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, I recently interviewed Dr. Gunhild Stordalen, founder and executive chair at EAT, the global nonprofit platform for food system transformation. It's a fascinating exploration of how our food system really needs to change. Just go to the site and search her name. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.